available. Then you have people assigned to ISACs, although still bought and paid for by their own agencies.
Okay.
Then you realize that as you begin to flesh this thing out, you're going to have a nationwide or South Vietnam-wide field organization as well as a headquarters. So you have a headquarters staff. You're going to need people.
Okay.
A lot more people than you'd envisioned. So the Army becomes the principal source.
Okay.
So the Army then decided that it would provide, and we came up with a staff type organization, so many people at the province, so many people at the region, mm-hmm. and so forth. Most of these people came from the Army, right? In due course, a TO was set up, and I can't place this precisely in time because I've forgotten it, to be honest with you. A TO was set up which assigned people to region, mm-hmm. or corps, and then to province. Most of them were Army. Okay. I think like you had a captain at the local level, and maybe at the region you had a lieutenant colonel or a major, mm-hmm. with assistants and corporals and so forth.
Yes.
All right. MACV then took the bodies at first as they came into country or were they're in country and assigned them, regardless of the fact they may have been intended for something else.
Okay.
For instance, I may have had as my deputy a guy that was going to be a regional advisor.
Okay.
In a military thing, in other words, a purely military. But instead of that, he finds himself in this. And I may have a fellow that was going to be assigned to J2. Instead of that, he's assigned it to an intelligence function under ISACs or under Phoenix.
Okay.
That's where all these people came from.
Okay.
So, and then as the program went on, the people were identified in the States before they got out to Vietnam, and then even were trained in
right.
the States.
Okay.
Or at least trained to some extent in the States. The ones that had no intelligence training or no experience, we tried to give at least an orientation in country, and then we actually set up a training program in country about a week long.
At Vung Tau.
At Vung Tau, right.
And that was something that happened under your directorship?
Yeah, at least it all got started on my directorship.
Okay.
It may be run a few times, but so that by the time John gets there,
mm-hmm.
this guy.
Yes.
The basic framework has been set up. People are assigned in the field. The Army is paying for its share, and the other people are simply assigned.
And what point is that?
I was there for about a year and a half. Let's see. I'm sorry.
Halfway through 69, perhaps?
Yeah, at least in 69, I guess. Yes, I left in 69. So by that time, you had the staff structure in place. The people were about their business. And then it was simply making sure that as new people arrived in country, the military primarily, they knew what they were doing. Okay. Meanwhile, we were working with the Vietnamese to sell them the idea. It was sold the idea. The police obviously Vietnamese police obviously had a major role in it, because after all, you're dealing primarily with civilians.
Yep.
But the Army did assist. And a Vietnamese structure is set up,
okay.
very similarly, regional, province.
And also the staff.
Yeah, and the staff. Now the staff, at first we simply used people just as I had done, people mm-hmm. who were already doing other things.
Okay.
Then a Phoenix staff was set up by the Vietnamese, primarily of people from the police, the national police.
Okay.
They had to set up in quarters for them and so forth. The two organizations had separate quarters because we wanted the Vietnamese to feel that Phoenix was a Vietnamese
mm-hmm.
program, and that the Americans were simply advisors, which is parallels everything else we did in country, but we're not in command of anything. Although obviously certain of the Vietnamese things were more responsive than others.
Okay. Well, I understand that the Prime Minister himself was on the Phoenix staff.
Well, he wasn't on the staff at all. He just says, "Do it."
Okay. All right.
I mean, he was a very sharp guy. And okay. He gave the order and he wrote the letters of the
okay, empowered it to
empower them to do it. One of the great problems with the Vietnamese in getting this thing started is that the thing was the classification of the directives was so high in order to prevent it from falling into the hands of the enemy that it was very difficult to handle these documents in the field. You know, they were secret or top secret. And the safeguarding of these things is very difficult. So that made it hard to get it out to, the province and tell people what they're supposed to do. But there were very specific organizational directives. Now, one thing that did occur that I personally didn't really think was right, and that is I didn't think that we needed an elaborate structure everywhere in the country. Mm-hmm. I didn't think that some of these provinces, for example, had enough people in them or had enough activity in them to warrant trying to staff out everywhere. I would have preferred to concentrate on the more populated areas or the more active areas where you knew that you had people to work with and also something to work against.
Yeah.
That both we and the enemy had something going on and we could concentrate.
I was originally going to do my study based on one province from each region, which I thought was the most active. I was going to do like Quang Tri and I Corps.
Yeah.
Bin Din in 2 Corps, Bin Hoa in 3 Corps, and Vin Long in 4 Corps, and see how I use them as examples.
Yeah, well, that would have been all right. That'd be okay. Because there were differences.
Yeah.
And so the differences really almost were personal differences.
Right, depending on who the province chief
was. The province chief,
right.
Or the police chief, and the kind of... even the advisors.
Yeah. Okay, who was your then? Who became your counterpart? Which Vietnamese individual do you remember?
Well, actually, the people I worked most closely with was the Director General of Police.
Okay,
I had no actual counterpart.
So you worked most closely
with the police because that's what was their responsibility. Although there were military working with them.
In 1968, General Lan was shot up pretty bad. In that incident.
I think he was a ranger or something like that. I can't think of his name, although he was a very fine person. A very, very straight guy. He and his assistant were very good. I think he was killed or killed himself to avoid capture by the DC. Very tragic. I'm not sure of that. But at the top level, in other words, at the heads of police, it's only when you get out in the field where you find, and having this the special branch have such a key role made it somewhat difficult because in many provinces, in many more of the more rural areas, if you will, the head of the special police, or the special police officer, was probably the equivalent of a sergeant. So if you get him a key role in it, he doesn't have much clout. After all, he's not even an officer. and the police also are pretty subordinate to the military, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And you have all the business of army versus police. They're two different organizations. You have to wonder that it worked at all.
Okay. I thought I might remind you.
Rather than catching infrastructure. But you had to have
something to work with.
Because we had to have something to work with, and since nobody knew what they were doing, and nobody had ever been trained for it, except the agency guys. Well, anyway, to sort of make it quickly, we went through this organizational phase. The Vietnamese went through the same thing, pulling together police and whatever, trying to set up staffs of some sort, find places for them to sit, provide them pencils and paper, and then to try to get them to actually conduct some kind of operations. And here you come to the nitty-gritty.
Okay.
Basically, the PRU were effective, at least in many areas. They would go out and chase around after infrastructure or conduct mm-hmm. operations which would produce some sort of results. In some areas, the police were effective. In many areas, I would say probably more got done in capturing, they were sort of military operations.
Yeah.
They got a military presence. So, and it varied really according to what was available in terms of facilities, I mean, people.
And this is exactly what the program is designed to do,
well,
to use resources wherever they were.
Yeah, to use, and but even more than that, it depended upon the personality and the personal likes and dislikes or preferences of the senior Vietnamese people in the field.
Okay.
So you don't have a uniform program, you don't have the same kind of response as you might expect, let's say, from a British unit or American unit or something like that.
Where the personality is subordinated to...
Yeah.
Or
even the political situation. For instance, there in I-Corps, there was a lot of activity, not so much concerned with the Viet Cong infrastructure, as you were with the machinations of rival political parties.
The Buddhists in particular.
Well, Buddhists or whatever.
Was there something other than the Buddhists?
Yeah, I'm trying to think what they were. These are things that...
This is the real hard stuff to remember.
Yeah. These are things that hung over from the French days. You had various and sundry...
Okay. Oh, okay, you mean like the Dai Viet Party?
Dai Viet and things like that. In other words, the other political activities which...
Nationalist or
whatever. Weren't necessarily working hand in glove with the government.
Yep.
Okay. There's always the problem of too that you run into something like this when you're sort of open season
okay.
on the enemy of settling scores.
Okay.
So let's say now you've got people, you have some sort of a structure set up, some sort of facilities, money or resources be available to them. People are captured, people are interrogated, and so forth. Then you need a record-keeping system. Then COMA was a great one on setting objectives and then keeping score of your performance against those objectives. This is sort of...
Is that how quotas get developed?
Exactly. So then they came up with the idea, well, I resisted like mad quotas. I thought that quotas would result in cheating or people being arrested and this being and looking good on a quota or not even being names listed on arrest reports that didn't exist. In some areas I was told that they were taking names off of gravestones. Not literally, at least the equivalent of that.
Ex post facto?
Yeah. Anyway, you had this and they had quotas they had this, and they would tried to meet their quotas. I think the reports of actual accomplishment in terms of captures, in terms of, although killing wasn't the name of the game, in a lot of cases, because that had to be listed anyway. You've got the idea that this is some sort of a murder organization.
Let's talk a little bit, maybe just a second. Maybe I could ask.
Because you've got lots of. Yeah. Information previously given. Why don't you ask questions?
Okay, maybe I'll just try. I certainly want to give you an opportunity to say what you think are the important points.
Okay,
if you feel you've
I think I've given you the outline roughly and crudely, as I recall.
Okay. Did you yourself have a personal staff that you relied on? For instance, William Colby always had four people, one
right.
for reports, one for...
The people that I relied on
okay.
were these people here.
That many?
Well, those are the yeah. Army guys. That shows us the thing at a certain time. That's pretty late in the game. Now, we had that many people. Now,
let me count for it.
There's all sorts there. some of them worked directly with the Vietnamese. In other words, they were advisors to the Vietnamese. Okay. Some of them worked directly in our own office, keeping our own, doing our own bookkeeping. In other words, my own staff, if you will.
Okay. I guess that's what I was getting at. Is there a core group within this?
That's the headquarters group. Now, okay. Within that, there are probably three or four people that I counted on more than anyone else. But that isn't the whole thing. In order to make this thing work, mm-hmm. I would say that the core people were the agency guy in charge of the police, that's special police. Mm-hmm. I mean the senior agency advisor. Now I'm not sure that I want you to use this in print or any place.
Okay, well, at any time you want me to turn that off, but I did...
Yeah, but in other words, the key... Yeah. Leaving aside the key people are John Monopoly and myself, because he had so much to do with the police and his people. That is on the American side.
Okay.
In a staff sense.
Okay. But Monopoly himself is not on this?
No, that's just the people working directly for me. See, Monopoly has his own book. Monopoly is actually, in a way, senior to me. He's the senior senior police advisor in the country. I didn't have that kind of a responsibility.
Okay.
And this is a staff responsibility. See, we didn't command anybody. We simply gave a directive in the name of Mac B, mm-hmm. or in the name of Colby or Comer. And it was done through the actual commanders. It was done through the chief of police. It was done through an army colonel or something like that.
Okay. I noticed, can't help noticing, Bobby Inman.
Yeah. That's a different Inman, I assure you.
Oh, it is? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I was going to say, what was Navy doing there? The Navy doesn't even have lieutenant colonels.
They might have lieutenant commanders, though. Yeah, lieutenant colonel. I don't think we had any
word. Word was
he's lieutenant colonel.
Okay. But there were no Navy people, though.
Mm-mm. I think at the outset we had one or two Navy. But
and I noticed that
I didn't love a lot of briefing in the country. I used the brief. Reporters that were referred to me by the agency or came knocking in the door, and I briefed the New Zealand ambassador for some reason. Because they were allies, they had people in the country that...
One of the reasons that you have been chosen was your persuasive powers? That you had, would that have made a consideration?
No, because I firmly believe in a soft sell.
Okay. Well, that's what I mean. Did they think soft sell was what needed?
They had their orders. See.
Okay.
And after all, this is a military organization, and they're responsible. And Comer said you do it, and Colby's also a very soft-spoken person,
mm-hmm.
and they say you'll do it. So my job is say, okay, Colby said to do this, and this is how you're going to go about it. This is what you expected. In other words, what I did is help the people to carry out what they were ordered to do.
Okay.
I was, in effect, an advisor, just like everybody else on the Corps-wise. They're all advisors.
Did you know William Colby previously? Was he your division chief?
He was my division chief in the field and in Washington. Also, I was served with him in World War II when I was in England.
So you go way back. You wouldn't happen to be Princeton?
Yeah, Cornell.
Okay. In New York.
No, I met him when we were both assigned. We were both in a program that was known as the Jedburghs.
Yeah, sure.
And he went into the field in Europe, and I went into the field in the Far East.
Yeah.
And then I then ran into him again, although I considered him one of the better people in the Jedburghs, certainly the best of all the young colonels.
Mm-hmm.
Longshot. And I ran into him next in Washington when he was the FE division chief, before he went out to Vietnam.
Okay.
And Colby did replace Colmer during your tour.
Oh yeah.
And when Colby traveled, Colby's method of operation is very interesting. He would suddenly say, "Let's go visit so and so in a province or a region." That meant he would call up and get a helicopter or a plane with no notice, and he would just go there and see them. Or he doesn't know he's coming, but there was very little notice. That made it a whole lot more secure, because we traveled without bodyguards or anything like that.
You did.
And oftentimes you'd say, "Ev, let's go. We're going to go visit so-and-so."
I heard a very interesting story from a man who had been a province officer in charge in Quang Tri about a time that William Colby showed up. And he said most people came to Quang Tri at 9 in the morning and left at 4 in the afternoon, but Colby spent the night, and which worried this man, because every night they got shelled.
Oh, sure.
So he said he had one of his Nung guards told him that his mission in life was to protect William Colby body and soul, and that that night, sure enough, they got mortared. And the Nung guards picked him up, he said, it was interesting, by a scruff of the neck, dragged him kicking and screaming down steps into a bunker, threw him on a cot, and laid on top of him until the shelling was over. And the province officer, the province officer thought, "This is it. This is, I'm going back to the United States. It's all over." But the next morning at breakfast, Colby complimented the Nung for his act, doing what he did. The guy, this guy went on to a fine military career.
Yeah. Well, that's Colby. Colby is a fine gentleman, I'll tell you.
He's been a big help to me.
Yeah. And, he's very helpful. He was tremendously helpful to me. Well, Colmer was helpful too. Colmer, their personalities are very different.
Well, I'd be interested to hear your if you care to give them your opinion.
Colmer essentially was sort of a raspy, grating kind of voice, but he was very, very consistently staunch in his support of the program. He believed in it, and he wanted it to work, and he was, on a personal basis, I'd say, in some very gracious. I mean, he may have, gave orders, may have been sarcastic, he may have been a rasping voice and all that, all those things.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, he was very consistent in push, go, do this and do that. He was not one to stand on ceremony, not one to do things because it was, that's all the way it always been done. He didn't give a damn about that. He said, "If you've got four, I want Parker's organization giving four trucks, I don't give a goddamn where they come from, give him four trucks." Or whatever.
Yeah.
Colby was more quiet, easygoing, not easygoing, that isn't right. I'd say more soft-spoken, but he was just as firm in terms of getting with them. The interesting thing about him is that his relationship with Kim, oftentimes they would travel around the country in the same airplane.
With Kim?
The director of the Interior.
Oh, okay. All right, sure.
Each sitting there with his open briefcase, with his stack of paper that he's working on, writing like mad, answering their memoranda, writing memoranda, passing memoranda back and forth to each other.
Uh-huh.
See, there's your coordination on this stuff. They'd bring me into it when it affected me, but I was along for my purposes.
Which were?
Simply to deal with the program, and also so that either one of them or both could use his authority to support what I was asking the Vietnamese or the Americans to do.
Okay, so in the sense of policy, you're not involved with making a policy?
Yes, for the program.
Okay.
Yes. But in the name of the Director of Courts, because he's, for my own group, I made policy, yes, but then if I was dealing with people from my own organization, I had the support. Behind me is my chief.
Were you able to think of yourself as disassociated from the station? Or were you basically thinking...
Turn it off. Okay. A leading role. The agency is no longer to have a leading role. The agency people in the field, the province, corps, and so forth, was turn their attention to their own business of intelligence and so forth, continued to assist and cooperate with the program, but no longer provide a leading role, as I said, and let the military staff officers who have been provided with the MACD take over. In order to, now I want you to shut it off.
Okay.
Civilian rank was the equivalent, I guess, of a major general.
Now, how can that be if you're a reserve lieutenant colonel?
No, I was out there as a GS, first of all, as a GS-15, then GS-16.
Okay.
See, so when you get a military organization, they pay a lot of attention to both civil and military ranks.
Okay.
But when you're speaking for the ambassador, for a guy that has ambassadorial rank, as Comer did and Colby mm-hmm. did and all the rest of them, seem to have, I think, four or five of them were some ambassadors. And these senior fellows that I worked with were darn fine people. You know, they didn't stand a lot of ceremony.
Yeah.
Particularly Colby.
Yeah. And
they were there to get a job.
Did you have were you in as many personal situations with Robert Comer as you were with William Colby? Was Robert Comer going to provinces, visiting provinces?
Not so much, not quite so much. Going to region, yes.
Okay.
But Colby more, I would say, more frequently to the field. See, Comer, during the Comer period, we were still in an organizing, mm-hmm. and only then getting into the action. He was always urging us to get into action. In Colby's period, that urging you to get on with the thing, mm-hmm. get some programs, get some actions going.
Okay.
That continued. And
but he's more hands-on.
Colby was more of a hands-on.
Okay.
This is not to say that Comer wasn't, because he was, but his whole approach was a little different.
How did you
it's
go
a
about
different personality?
Okay, how did you go about determining who your first ISEX coordinators were going to be? Region coordinators. How did you decide on Jim Wall and Robert Wall?
They were handed to me.
Okay.
By the chief of station.
And were they already the agency officers in charge?
They were the senior officers in the field.
As a matter of curiosity, Ralph Johnson's paper said he was deeply involved with Phoenix. What was Ralph Johnson's role? Did you know Ralph Johnson then in those days?
Well, he was in his area. I guess he was. What's the name of the post?
In the south.
Yeah, Vontar, I think he was.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was involved in it simply as it coincided with his agency functions in the field. And his relationships with the Vietnamese. So one of the advantages he had was his language.
He had Vietnamese?
I don't know, Vietnamese or French. I know he had very good French. And he was there for a long time.
Was he covert operations?
I don't know.
I didn't know. Okay. It's Ralph Johnson being deceased.
Yeah.
And having written this dissertation, which is going to be fundamental to my book, I really would like to get some information on it.
I really don't know what his, because he was out there for so long. I don't know whether he was there in some so-called covert role or overt role. I really don't remember.
It's too bad. I wish I knew, because I'd like to give him credit for whatever it was that he did.
Well, he was working primarily with the Vietnamese, but just exactly what his detailed functions were, I don't know.
What kind of a fellow was he? Was he gregarious?
Very gregarious, very affable, very personable. Very nice looking. He was a bachelor then. Very nice looking guy. Very friendly.
Would he have had any friends that anybody who he's close to that I might be able to get some insights about him for?
I always end up getting
more papers in my lap.
Where I have difficulty in this is I have difficulty separating out what his agency roles were and what he did with things. So I just assume I go into any detail.